Blog Talk Radio.
Things relevant to the nature of Freemasonry around the world, in our minds and in our hearts. Yeah, lots going on. I think you're going to enjoy the narrative. You're going to enjoy the commentary today. Resilience, time, and the evolution of understanding. It's not as chewy as you might think. So, thank you for tuning in again. And I want to do make mention of our listeners from Russia. Congratulations on winning a gold medal at the Olympics in hockey. I think that's brilliant. Anyway, I think we can all share in their joy. Hard-fought battles all over the place, but the spirit of sportsmanship just prevails. So congratulations. Pyeongchang, wonderful, interesting Olympics. I mean, just overwhelming for an old boy the likes of me to see that kind of youthful vitality and creativity. Remarkable. And to those whose spirit is suffering, focused on some of the areas of conflict, I want you to know that this might help a bit. I'm not here to speak at all with the kind of conviction that we get from the Holy See or other sources of solace in these dark times. No, I'm here to simply say that the world around us is making progress. Although we see it not, there is progress being made. The struggle to reduce poverty has never been so successful. Yes, there are still moments of poverty, but don't make the mistake. Here, I want to caution each of our listeners here. Don't make the mistake of confusing weather with climate. Weather, you stick your head out the door and it's raining, or you stick your head out the window and there's sunshine. And don't, using that kind of experience, that's weather. Using that kind of experience to comment on climate change is ridiculous. Climate is what happens when we add all of the open windows all over the world for many, many years. We add them all together and we see the trends. That's climate. You ask me, what's it like this time of year here? Well, we've had a wet season. Well, not entirely, no. Today it is, but that's not to say that it's a comment about the entire pattern of our climate. Our climate, we work and live in affected by climates, and we might as well recognize that there's a difference between our experience and the big picture. Each of our experiences are legitimate. It's not to invalidate it, but to presume that it's the center of the universe. Come on now. We've had enough of that. Galileo took that up for us. So realize that we're an important facet in that overall conversation. Our experiences are not the most important. Never, ever, ever, ever make that mistake. That's hubris. You know, we begin to think that way, and then to think that it immediately discounts the viewpoint of another brother. and another one of the brethren. And that's just limiting ourselves. And it's a discourtesy to our great order. So faith, we have a deep faith, and we have convictions, and we have a sense of virtue about our work. So as we go about our work in the past couple of days, and in the future, we want to, I think, and we deserve to feel emboldened by our being simple, humble students of the arts and sciences. They give us that sense of tomorrow. They give us that sense of there's something more than this corporeal existence. There's something maybe we're still struggling as we're students of Plato. You know, Socrates writes about Socrates saying, you know, a life unexamined is not worth living. Well, yeah, I think there's got a lot of merit in that. If you don't have a clue who you are, well, you know, maybe God's blessed you with a bit of daffiness, that's all right. But in the larger scheme and the climate of humanity, not so much. We need to have some sense, as you know, you've walked through the door with your own 2 feet planted firmly on the ground, making that leap of faith that there's something bigger and better here. Now, if the meagerness of character is what's holding you back, look deeply into the mirror. Don't be pointing me. You know, you can point the fingers at masonry. I won't say don't. You'll do that anyway. Point the fingers at masonry. Point them at the callousness of what's in that conversation that you overheard in lodge. Do all of that. And at the end of the day, take a serious, deep look at the mirror. Because the enemy within is the enemy without. Here we've got something. We're here to talk about things enlightened, and we've got a pretty interesting time on the go. We're going to start it off with that universal language, that symbolic language. So some music here, and why jazz? You might ask. Well, as you've heard me talk about the jazz being a universal music. Think about it. It came from people that were subjected to racism and were blocked from opportunity purposefully. This is a grotesque moment on the face of the earth, and in some ways in those countries it still is. But this is the symbol of that. Spirit, that can do spirit. And often I think it weakens our lodges when we come up with ideas. And boy, we need some ideas. There's no question about that. Now, we need to be able to articulate our confidence and our convictions in a different way than we have in the past. So this is about the energy that it takes to do that. There's a spirit and a genius in this music. It was innovative, and it's unlike anything that ever happened before it, similar but unlike it. And it's spontaneous, it has that spontaneity. When you got away from the boot heel of oppression, what happens is that spontaneity. And we hear about that with Holocaust survivors, that spirit, could not be held down. You can kill the man, you can kill the woman, you can kill the child, but you can never kill the idea. Here, this is called, of course, this is by Ron Carter. The universal language, those things are in common with all of us. That notion of oppression and suppression, those are things that are common to the human condition. And how it's not that they exist, it's how we respond to them. We go about our business in spite of all of that totalitarian thinking. Oh, wouldn't it be easier if everybody was in a bloody uniform? Then you could just order them around. Well, nah, you can order yourself around. That's been tried. Doesn't work. And it's not easier. It's complicated. But then you get groups like us where there's times when we willingly fall into line. We're more like the symphony. Nobody forces you to play that perfect piece on the cello. Nobody tells you. There's not an authority. If you don't do it right, we're going to ground you. It's because you have the talent and because you have the ear. You have the ear to listen for, to appreciate. You know that groove when the symphony comes together and it's a common purpose where you're taken outside of yourself. You contribute to a body of work that is much more than what you can produce as a solo performer, as a solo artist. And when we listen to that, then we're listening to Pastor I, or we're listening to Haydn's Oxford Symphony. You're hearing that, je ne sais quoi, that moment when it all just comes together. And as Thelonious Monk has been known to say, and I pass this on, I think it's very fitting for Freemasons, there is no wrong note. There is no wrong note. So, and who could play off of that better? We're going to hear a little bit of him later. Well, Miles Davis could play. There was no wrong note. You could lead, finish your session, your piece, your passage on anything, and he could pick it up and make it sublime. And that's you. You pick up the broken bits around you. Michelangelo did it. Da Vinci did it. You know, you pick up Michelangelo's work, and what would he do? He'd find a piece of beautiful marble that had been started by another sculptor of less talent, you know. And what he would do is re-carve it. And all of a sudden, you know, there's that eye, there's that cheek, there's that nape of the neck, there's that gesture, and then there's that passion and the expression and the action. Only he was really making do with what he had at hand. Shame on you for thinking that you don't have the talent. Shame on you. Yes, you do. Do you have the talent to be quiet, or do you want to play your little fiddle the whole time through the symphony because it's your fiddle and you spent a lot of time on it? Well, you just stand up and play that fiddle. And the heck with the score, the heck with the conductor, the heck with the horn section. Just you play that little fiddle and play your little heart out there, and then go away and break all the mirrors around you because you're just a damn fool and you know it. Anyway, here's a little Ron Carter, The Shadow of Your Smile. Oh, fabulous, fabulous. Thank you. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. That's Ron Carter playing bass in that piece, who's also a well-recorded cellist. Just the bass, that sound, that tone that emulates the heartbeat, that draws the listener toward the music. So listen to it. You can tell when it's not there. But Carter plays, and all of a sudden it's sort of that caprice. You know, the beautiful little play, there was multiple beats. It's like the heart fluttering with something exciting. And did you hear the shadow of your smile? It's just that gentle groove that draws you in. Well, yeah, thanks for I want to talk to the fellows in Uganda that have been tuning in. Thanks. I hope I don't know how to say it in the language of the day, so I say it through jazz and through our conversation here in English. And the Philippines, thank you very much for tuning in again. And France, I'm so pleased. I always think of French masonry as having an attitude of sophistication. And I like to think of Canada as still that younger cousin sitting at the knee of the great artists. It's like going to La Scala, where we may build we have wonderful opera houses here, but going to La Scala, it's sort of you know what I mean. It's like going to the Louvre or the Hermitage. It's just and our listeners from India, I know that you're connecting with us, and I'm so very, very pleased that we have a voice. Now, remember, you can send your comments and thoughts and reactions to us through Masonic Effects at Masonic Effects in all one word on Twitter, and we have a Gmail account, MasonicEffects@gmail.com, if you're so inclined. We have some interesting speakers. I've been talking about that and tease the listeners, but some of the speakers have been a bit daunting when they said yes. Oh, we'll talk to you. It's like, I don't want to make a fool of myself. I want to say something purposeful. I want to have a conversation that's purposeful and productive and contributes and answers questions and makes connections. And we have things to do. But before I go on, I want to talk to you a bit. I want to get into the commentary for today. We're going to talk a little more about the symbolism. I think we're sort of, making ourselves self-evident. We're trying to knock it up a gear here. That's all we're doing. We're taking masonry and knocking it up a gear. There's no slumber around here about masonry. This is enthusiasm. This is where you, the listeners, are the committed bunch. Oh, I won't tell anybody. I know that you're not sitting in the stands. You're not observers of this. You're actually on the field. You're active and you're participating. And I don't mean active by showing up at every. This isn't like I check off your attendance. We're not civil servants here. Whether you attend, are the lights on? And we may wonder. We may be quite fine to attend the meeting, and somebody will give me a 10-minute lecture on how there's nothing wrong with that, blah, 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 but are the lights on? We're the people that you may go into, think of it as going into the studio, and the room has some very talented, unknown sculptors and painters in it, and you're there, and some people will get the idea that this is an atmosphere of creativity. Others may see it just as dust. And others may be just thinking in those ridiculous boyish terms that there's a breast or a leg, or, they won't see the purpose. This is the purpose. This is what this is about, yeah. So sit back for a second. Refill. Go and refill. Put us on hold. Go and refill. Well, probably better if you reveal before you listen to Masonic effects. Here's I want to get into this commentary today, and I want a little bit of feedback from you. Not a lot, I don't know, a little bit of feedback about what you're thinking. We're on that verge, eh? We're on that verge. We're changing. Deep breath here, Graham. Imagination. Communication. How far can these elements take us? We are creatures of one and followers of the other. Where people are confused, they tend to be anxious. Where Masonic literacy is low, anxiety is highest. So the progress of the order will be as lumpy as the fits and spurts of interest in education. Freemasonry is on the threshold of an exciting time in our history. It has taken 600 years for us to reach this point, this moment. Beyond the dreams of dreamers, from the alchemists' laboratories, Freemasonry has appealed to people of vision. The limits of religion has been brought into the common understanding. Governments of the world have been on a march successfully reducing poverty, while leaders have failed the test of virtue and morality. And nature has always been asserting her dominance, as the air we breathe and the oceans we need have become toxic to our collective by our collective negligence. For all the grotesques that continue to exist, for all the conceits of mankind, the human race is an audacious species. Whatever may come, Freemasonry will bring purpose and direction, even as last days of light fail. The beacon from the West will be there in the hearts and minds of the builders. We have realized Freemasonry being a universal calling is not a choice for all people. That choice is being made clearer because we are communicators of the very ideas that give reason and freedom to the world. It could be no other way. As humble and opaque as ever, as an order, awkward and brilliant, easy to mock. We are that story that has prevailed through it all. The proof is in the grip, a smile, and an extension of friendship. Our work continues. Phil Miles Davis here. Yeah. Thank you. That's Wynton Kelly on piano. And that's tenor sax we just heard, just ripping into it. John Coltrane. Can you imagine? Just listening to it and never having heard it before and just being, you know, picking up on it in that same knowing each other's minds and just impressed and astounded by the great creativity of other people on the stage with you. So for anybody to say that was the day, think about it. It is the day. That music's still affecting you. It resonates. It still has a place. It's beyond the music of our childhood. Wasn't it interesting that we went about our business as the white establishment, criticizing the moral decline of black performers, not thinking at the moment that these were people that have been horribly abused, neglected, and the stories of neglect and abuse, well, I can knock on the door of how many different brethren, and in their background are stories of neglect and abuse and oppression. Is there one faith or one culture that doesn't include that? Who step forward? Who's the lucky man? Is it my Indian brethren or my Scottish brethren or my Irish brethren or my Russian brethren or my Chinese brethren? We all become tempered by our histories and our backgrounds. And some perhaps weak-minded people will feel it necessary to pick up weapons and try and fight on old battles. The old soldiers, you know, if you have the pleasure to talk to the old soldiers, and I'm sure we all have, you put down your weapons at some point, shake your head and move on and watch your kids grow up and take your dog for a walk and enjoy a good cup of coffee or a glass of wine or sunset. Or as I've heard from some really quite remarkable people, you go for a run through Beijing early in the morning and experience the sounds of the city. Can you imagine? And all those experiences still go on. So for more youthful listeners, regardless of your age, that moment has not passed you by. If you've decided that it has passed you by, Masonry is, after all, about being in the moment. It's that original mindfulness, isn't it? It's just transcendent. Well, enough, man. Come on, move on with it. We're not here to listen to all of this kind of stuff, so we'll anyway, that's the effect this day of Miles Davis on the likes of me and some of you. I get a chance today, though, to speak about one of those people that I most want to sit down with, if ever. You know, it's like if you could sit down with any woman in the world to have a drink, who would she be? Or any man, who would it be? Well, I used to think it couldn't be anyone more fascinating than Elizabeth Taylor or Queen Noir. Just brilliant, brilliant. Or Angela Merkel. Or Naomi Klein, Bella Abzug. You know, just staggeringly amazing people. Or would I want to speak with Jean-Pierre Rimpel, or Picasso, or, you know, think about the lists of people that you could, you know, who would have the pleasure of your company? Who would it be? Would it be Coltrane? Would it be Webster? Would it be, you know, who would it be? Aznavour. Or would it be somebody as beautiful of spirit as the poet that I've selected for today? Yeah. Sit back. Deep breaths. Relax. Get into the moment with us here and enjoy. I haven't even finished exploring the depths of Alexander Pushkin's work. Haven't. And I'm not going to be able to let go until I do. And it's like the motive here is that search for understanding the mind. I don't want to just say, oh, well, he's part of the golden era of Russian poetry. No, that's just, for me, that's a little too glib. I want it to be about, I need to have a sense of the artist and this spirit of this thinker, this amazing figure. He can look at something. This is what always astounds me about the artist. And I'm talking about the artist in you, whether you've developed the talent or not, whether you put in the practice, that's another thing. A very lovely old friend of mine once told me the reason that I wasn't good with hand tools and building things at the time was because I didn't practice. I'd never been taught. And I realized he was right. And he has been at it for years and years, and he's just remarkably talented and beautiful too. The work that he produces is astounding. All self-taught, and he's from masonry to woodwork to, and you know what he puts his hand to. He needs something in metal. Well, he teaches himself how to weld. dear. This is the spirit in you, the artist in you. That's what, when we look at what's on the wall, when we're looking at a Constable or a Turner or Canaletto, you know, you're looking at something that resonates within you. And if you sit and look and give it a moment, if you look at a Van Gogh, the last time I had a chance to see it, was went up to Ottawa to see that, some at the National Gallery. And just being in the moment and having a few minutes where the crowds had just wandered away and just sat there. And it was like this, you know, this, I get it. You begin to get it. You begin to see you see what's in the artist's mind. And the color and the composition and the story. What was he telling me? You do that. What you see around you appeals to that part of you. Do you challenge it, or do you cover your eyes with a blindfold when you go into an art gallery? Do you put those little earplugs in when you go to the symphony? Here, silly buggers. For all of you that haven't experienced it, do you want to know the appeal of opera and symphony? Okay. Here it is. Have any of you heard of a rave? Do you know a rave? Tune it in. Get on the internet and just check it out. It is like unconditional adrenaline, nonstop. It's like the arpeggios all day long, all night long, hour and hour and hour, with light. It's amazing, and you feed off that energy in the crowd. Have you been to a football match where the crowd is just inflamed by what's happening on the field? You know that energy. Or when you're sitting in the middle of the theater and little Sparky is up there singing his little heart out with his little costume on, doing his best, or little Sally is dancing her little heart out, and she's on stage. You know, she's the epitome. You know that feeling when all the people in the room get it? Well, yeah, it's like that. You get it. So the reason for opera and the appeal of symphony was that they were the first rock concerts. Yes, once upon a time, I got talked into going to Woodstock. Can you imagine? That's pretty amazing. I had to be convinced. Yeah, I really want to go. It's going to be expensive. It didn't cost anything at the end of the day, except. But what it does, these experiences, is take you out of yourself. Remember, it wasn't that long ago that these concerts were being banned in certain places in the world because it wasn't. You're not too sure. You know, are they going to lose control and just become anarchists? Well, if you've been to some of these concerts, the last thing you want to do is be in conflict when you're done. Eh? The last thing. It's like you're in a good place, and everybody else is in a good place around you. It's a shared experience. The very first of that were operas, you know, where the theater, dance, music, and song came together. It's the epitome. It takes all of the arts, and brings them together in this moment, this pinnacle, and then the storyline, the librettists, and the music. They draw on an aspect of the human condition that is resilient, that drama, the life and death and craving. And, you know, if you're seeing Madame Butterfly in her anguish as she realizes the captain has rejected her, you know, there's something soft and beautiful about those moments. And what does she do? She keeps it to herself. And then we struggle with her. Don't die, Butterfly, you know. For hundreds of years we do that. So can you imagine writing? Well, we're 20 years old, and we want to be part of that vibe, and we want to be part of what's happening. Once upon a time, that was masonry. And it's not like saying, oh, well, that day's come and gone. Hell, it has. We have new cutting-edge music going on around us all the time. The arts has continued to evolve. The communication has accelerated. The amount of intelligence and information and fact that we're able to exchange, along with a lot of the propositions and weak-minded but populist kind of thinking, is all there. It's all accelerated progress. We like to just cut it off and say, oh, well, progress, good or bad or different. Well, you're part of that. So anyway, the very first, the exciting part was in that period in the 18th century, 17th, 18th century, when it hadn't been done before. Well, if it hasn't been done before, doesn't that make the a real genius, the dedicated, insightful person that doesn't need the praise of the crowd? You know, these are people that don't need the praise of the crowd to do what they do. They do it because it is absolutely, Beethoven did it because it was absolutely beautiful. Well, all right. Maybe it was because he was encouraged by Haydn. Mozart was certainly encouraged by Papa Haydn. And maybe they were all encouraged, of course, by the Baroque musicians. They're encouraged by the brilliance of Bach, you know. I mean, okay, but it continued to evolve. So don't you be there telling me these things didn't happen or you don't understand. That I can certainly appreciate. But at the time, it's that enthusiasm, that sense of that drive for creativity to do something that expresses you, not to do something because you want to compete with some other person. That's like Henry Ford stealing ideas. You know, he steals Tesla's ideas. And the world around us is full of ideas, thieves. I mean, you know, weak-minded, but they don't amount to much because they steal an idea and then they don't know where it came from and they don't know what to do with it. So they steal the idea, move on. Move on. You're capable of far, far more. So do you think that all of the great creators of the world never had their as they say, you know, duplication is a compliment. People that copy your style. Well, of course, it's not like, oh, do they do it better? Well, maybe Katie Lang does crying better than, you know, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, here's a bit on Alexander Pushkin, though. Look for the beauty in this and think about him in his day. Oh, gee, you could say that today, couldn't you? You sit down and you think about the world around you only for a second, instead of ignoring the detail, you penetrate the detail, and then you penetrate the meaning, and then you connect it with your soul. Well, can you just, I'm impatient, you know, put your little old fists together and bang on a desk, you know, or take off your slipper and bang it on the desk, you foolish old buggers. Or you connect. And it begins as a thought, doesn't it? An active thought, a prevalent thought. And what the artist does is put down what they see in their in their with their eye, but they have to disconnect all the baggage and all the thinking, all the waves. My family gave me a great book on meditation a little while ago. And and the author, John Van Rieck, talks about the waves. And the waves are always around us. I'm always like the metaphor of floating on the ocean and a chip of wood. The waves are all around us. But there's times, if we're expecting that the waves are just going to be flat, well, it's never quite flat. I can say, well, it's glistening, you know, it's like a glass around the boat. But it's always a little bit of a wave. Doesn't mean I have to be troubled in the moment. I'm in this place like you are, where there's lots going on around us. And the more observant we are, the more we learn. Oh, gee, that was, wait, I want to write that down. That was bloody air. This is part of the golden age of Russian poetry. Russia has given us so much. I'm not talking about the riffraff throwing mud at each other. They treat our cultures like they were spectator sports. You know, we don't like them. They're the competition. So we've got to throw mud at them. They throw mud at us. Like, no. There's something more. Oh, gee, I'm beginning to sound like a bloody Mason. Oh, how do I do that? This is one of his beautiful poems, The High Road in Winter. And I'm just where I am. It's unlike you buggers down in New Zealand and Australia. I know you're sitting there with your beverage du jour and you're enjoying a summer's day. Well, I'm enjoying the end of, I'm facing spring and summer coming to me. You're facing the beauty of fall coming to you. So, indulge me a little bit. The high road in winter. Between the rolling vapors, the moon glides soft and bright. Across the dreary fallows, she casts a mournful light. Along the wintry high road, a troika moves fleet. Its little bells are ringing, one silver tone and sweet. Some echo of my country, the driver's song recalls. She's singing, eh? The memory of love yearnings and noisy bacchanals. Think back to your last noisy bacchanal, ladies and gentlemen. No lights, no black roofed dwellings, silence and snow I see. For mile on mile the road posts in striped monotony. So you're traveling along. What do? You sing. You distract yourself from the tedium, from the cold. People have done that forever. Forever. Absolutely. This is, I know it's playing on a, it's riffing on that. Ben Webster, this is Solitude from 1967. Ben Webster on tenor sax. Thank you. Could just take our breath away. Don't you just? That's Ben Webster. He was doing Solitude, and of course you know that was written in 1934 by Duke Ellington. It turns out Duke Ellington was a Freemason. Back in the day when you could imagine the amount of lynchings were going on of black people. Now there's a comeuppance or reaction, a revulsion, and I think it's appropriate. Get over it, you know, move on. It's going to take a while. Not everybody's going to do it on my schedule, you know. I want this done once, I apologize once, and that should be it. Grow up, Graham. That's not the way the world works. It's not the way you experience your grandmother doing some odd things, and then you find out grandma's been troubled, and then you find out she was raped when she was a little girl in the school. And it was perpetrated by a government controlled by people like me, in some ways, people exactly opposite from me in so many ways. Hey, the world is a symbolic place, and we thrive on the symbolism of music and the arts and to conduct our science. You know, the sciences have their own languages and their own symbols that are used, from mathematics to chemistry to, you know, if you remember the days trying to memorize the periodic table, trying to memorize it out of context. Can you imagine how painful that was for little boys named Graham? But this, get back, this is a guy that, I want to give you a little passage on. You were still talking about basic symbolism, and this is a man I so want to sit down and just have the greatest discussion in the debate, W.L. Wilmshurst. I cannot, you know, he fascinates me. He's writing in the 20th century, speaks of the great moral movements that periodically arise in world history. You okay with that? You okay with that? You know, hey America, hey, our homeboys here in Canada, hey Canada, you okay with this? So, bet you are. He says that these movements, you know, around the world and classes in its speculative nature, periodically arise. He says that these movements throughout history tend to exist outside of formal religion. At least it should be suggested that Masonry has at any time been a religion in itself or a substitute for formal religion. It should immediately be stated emphatically that this is not so. Hear, hear. Not so at all. The very tenets of Masonry require a member of the craft to be a religious man in the sense of holding some religious belief. And during the time when the guild system was in full swing, and when free and accepted Masonry was developed in the British Isles, that religion represented automatically the Christian faith. And so far as the English guilds were concerned in the years after the Reformation, that faith, according to the tenets of the Church of England, as that was the established church. So in guild histories, there are many references to religious connection, to the patronage of a particular saint, and certainly to formal attendance at regular church services. The exception too, developed with an automatic link with the church so far as the individual members were concerned. And when moral teaching or spiritualizing was concerned, it was in terms of the highest principles of the Christian faith. This regarded the Holy Bible as its sacred writings, and not only the New Testament, which dealt with the foundation of that faith, but also the Old Testament, which included the sacred writings of the Jewish religion, and a great deal of the history of the Hebrew people. If, by requiring the previous fulfilling of certain qualifications and conditions, societies seek to be selective in those they admit to membership, they must introduce means of showing existing members that the qualifications and conditions are fulfilled with respect to proposed new members. If membership involves the knowledge of certain protective secrets restricted to members, there must be some means, and preferably some formal means, of making the communication to new members and of ensuring that they are completely understood. In addition, there is a duty to ensure that such secrets restricted to a group of membership, in fact, remain secret. This may best be done by requiring some formal binding promise from those to whom the communication is made. Whereas in the case of the developing free and accepted Masonry, the society wished to accentuate certain teachings, tenets, and principles for the better conduct of life. What better than that they should consider the moral applications of aspects of the workaday world and use the principles of the trade with which they were associated, that of building, to illustrate and instruct in the building of a good life. Where a particular religion was second nature to all the members and a closer knowledge of the Bible, not just a desirable but considered a necessary attribute of the good man, it was natural that if further inspiration and illustration were required, they should be taken from the Bible or from the well-known tenets of the common religion. If there were to be several grades of membership, separate initiation into the secrets of each would be necessary. This was how Freemasonry developed. But all this did not happen overnight, and it probably took well over a century. Douglas Knopp and C.G. Jones have made a special study of the earlier aspects of Masonry and given it in their opinion in The Genesis of Freemasonry, written in 1949. It was almost certainly not until the second half of the 18th century that Masonry had become so modified in character that it could justly be defined as a peculiar system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. From Masonic records of the latter half of the 18th century, it's clear that there are and were general standards with regards to the principles, practices, and teachings of Freemasonry at the time. The need to meet together for ceremonies, business, and instruction gave rise to some standard forms of lodge layout. Not all were identical, as records show, and although the main business and instruction were carried out at the dining table, the ceremonies were carried out where possible in another room, as an excerpt from the minutes of old arms Lodge in 1801 shows, "It shall be incumbent for every member to continue in the lodge room until the steward, from the time being, shall have announced at the worshipful master that the supper room is arranged for his and the brethren's reception." See, we come back. See where the work was done? Over a meal. Old school. Old school. This wasn't a management. This wasn't, where management reigns supreme. No, this was common purpose. And this was closer to the old guilds. What would happen, you think, if the oldest lodges, the tradesmen came in, they got through the business of the day, the things that are important to them, and then you wanted to get into paying the bills, and it was no longer, it was just the usual drivel, things that you'd heard over and over again, what would happen? The lodge would empty. Oh, did I say that out loud? You want to talk about retention and stuff? Come back next week. We'll talk about retention and stuff. Thank you, the artist in you, for being patient and being kind and tuning in. Thank you, Brazil. Thank you, the UK and India and Canada. Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure. Talk to you again soon. This is Masonic Effects. Always a pleasure to be with you. Open one, sweet police, Shanova, Debbie, who the Shishanan, Shanova, open one, limousine, Billy, Open one, the personnel, Billy, and then one, and the Chabelle, the Pop, open one, the Tour Eiffel, Billy, Je veux l'amour, de la joie, de la bonne humeur. Je veux pas votre argent qui fera mon bonheur. Moi, je veux crever la main sur le cœur. Allons ensemble découvrir ma liberté. Oubliez donc tous vos clichés. Bienvenue dans ma réalité. J'en ai marre de bonnes manières, c'est trop pour moi. Moi je mange avec les mains et je suis comme ça. Je parle fort et je suis proche, excusez-moi. Fini l'hypocrisie, moi je casse de là. J'en ai marre des langues de voix. Regardez-moi, de toute manière, je vous en veux pas et je suis comme ça. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do